From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with the Queer Justice Director at the Hmong American Women's Association about how the organization is creating opportunities for Milwaukee's LGBTQ community. We'll learn about some local lesbian history and a project called House of History, which shares local Black LGBTQ history.
My goal is to get the word out that we're here. And a lot of the sacrifices that were made by some of the people who are no longer here, their legacy can live on.
Plus, we'll speak with the first openly transgender police officer in Wisconsin.
I am just the first of something. I'm sure that there are trans and non-binary officers that are on a force somewhere in the state of Wisconsin, somewhere across the United States.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll celebrate Pride Month by learning some local lesbian history and how Black LGBTQ history is being preserved here in Milwaukee. We'll start with this. On the last Friday of every month, members of the queer Hmong community gather around food, stories, and chosen family. Queer Roots Space is a program of the Hmong American Women's Association. It's meant to be a supportive, confidential space for the community. It's one of many queer justice programs that HAWA offers. WUWM's Lena Tran speaks with HAWA's Queer Justice Director, John Yang, about serving the queer Hmong community in Milwaukee.
I think there's a lot of spaces, you know, to support LGBTQ people on a mainstream level, right? And I think for us, there are issues that impacts like the Hmong and Southeast Asian LGBTQ community specifically. There's many nuances. A lot of time we see patterns and trends where survivors and community members are not building in a way that's healthy, that really can lead to like pathways to supporting their lives and really directing their lives in a better direction. For example, we see a lot of trafficking of older folks, trafficking like younger, like Southeast Asian LGBTQ people, you know, and those kind of relationships are really harmful. Even though a lot of time what we've seen is the young people really just need support, right? And like healthy relationships, right? And so for us, transformative relationships means cultivating a space for our people to really, really be able to build beyond just surviving, but to break silence of what they're going through, but also lean on each other in ways that transcends the coping mechanism of like drinking or like leaning on older folks who might not necessarily be like the safe person for them. Community can have healthy relationships, transformative relationships.
How do you do that if people feel like they've been alone?
Yeah.
How do you build trust like that?
So through our space, our monthly support spaces, which is called Queer Root Space, you know, there's no pressure, but I think that having a set agenda around like this space is really about, you know, sharing stories and, you know, also understanding where people might be at and also being compassionate, right? That people choose to do certain things and move in certain ways, not necessarily like at their choice. And we know that our people have limited choices, right? And so being able to meet our people where they're at and saying it's okay, but there are also other options, really helps people be able to see what options they can take, right? And how they can build differently with people. And I definitely think that like the journey to finding community is really important. Oftentimes they're positioned to be isolated, right? And we also see them like experiencing loneliness, but we want people to be able to tap into each other and address the loneliness and the isolation in healthy ways so then they can actually really experience community love.
What has that community meant to people participating in that queer root space that you've observed or that you've been hearing from people?
I think Milwaukee is kind of unique. I say this because I think that a lot of times when people think about LGBTQ spaces or support and resources for LGBTQ people, like Milwaukee is really not the place that people think about. For the Hmong community in particular, a lot of people think about Minnesota or the West Coast. And so through our queer root spaces, what we've heard and seen is that people actually are arriving, that this is actually their first moments and first time interacting with other Southeast Asian LGBTQ people. Of course, there's like the awe, right? But I think that it's actually the very first time they're hearing other people navigating very similar issues that they went through too. And so for us, that has been really great because we want people to actually build with each other and lean on each other and hear from each other. Like, actually, you navigated your parents like this, or I navigated coming out like this. I navigated transitioning resources like this, right? I think it's really needed in Milwaukee. And so those are the things that we've seen from people who's participated. People have actually lived here for like 10 plus years, been in relationship with their partners for years, but never actually had community beyond those relationships.
Well, I'm glad then that y'all are doing this work here. What are your roots here in Wisconsin?
I feel like it's like a weird journey, but I was born in California, and you know, I was a child of refugees. My parents were Hmong refugees. They actually moved us when I was 3 years old to North Carolina. And so I grew up in rural North Carolina because my parents like moved us to go farm there. So we lived on a farm up until I was 14. And then my mom was like, actually, I want you guys to go to school. I want you guys to go to college. And so where we were at, it wasn't like a pattern for like young people to go to college. And so she moved us, my family moved us to Milwaukee when I was 14. So I was able to finish high school here in Milwaukee. And then I transitioned into college. I started at the UWM actually, but then I transitioned out to the University of Minnesota. Because actually, at that time I was experiencing like a gender identity crisis. And so I think that my family wasn't in a position to really support me navigate that. And they were really unsure of that. And so I was looking for community too. This was like 10 years ago. There was another Hmong LGBTQ organization. They were the first LGBTQ Hmong organization in the Midwest, but they were in Minnesota. And so I knew there was a community out there. I actually moved there to find community, to build community. And that's how I kind of like entered into this work. My heart was always in Milwaukee because I've seen like what I didn't have, but I've also seen like what a lot of other people around me, young people around me who are also queer, that they didn't have, and not everyone was privileged enough to just get up and move to find community. I felt like there was a sense of responsibility to come back because in many ways, Milwaukee was really supportive to me. And so I wanted to also come back and make sure that I do my due diligence to the community here.
That's amazing. Milwaukee's lucky to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess I was curious. You know, you're doing this work to help people find communities here. And I was wondering if that was something that, as an individual here when you were younger, that you knew that you wanted or knew to look for. I guess at what point did you learn about what was going on in Minnesota or realize that that was something that you needed that the city didn't have at the time?
I would say, you know, for sure, I think that there was other queer young people of color here, and there were also other queer like Southeast Asian people here, right? At the time that when I was younger, but no one really talked to each other about it at that time. And if people were, you know, queer or identify as queer in the community, it's like those were just people that you kind of heard about. For me, like I really wanted like the face front interactions. I wanted to hear people's stories. I wanted to learn, you know, like how do we navigate our parents or our family around, you know, queer identity. But that wasn't happening. And so for me, I felt like it was important for me to try to build community and locate community. And for me, I guess that was in Minnesota. And that's when I really felt like it was a need. But I think the difference though, then when I arrived in Minnesota, because I think the community was at the Southeast Asian and Hmong community was at a really different place. And it made me think a lot about our community back here in Milwaukee. It made me think about like not just the gender identity resources, but the overall resources from housing to economic and employment opportunities, from like leadership programs that young people had access to, but we didn't have here. Like to me, it was like a whole realization of like, wow, it's almost like people in different parts of the country live in a different dimension with different resources. And it made me really sad to see that like so many of the young people around me who were also queer in Milwaukee didn't really have access to those things. It was hurtful, but you know, I think we had to start somewhere. And so that's why I returned back. And then there's been amazing people who, during that time too, who's been doing a lot of work too, to support like young people, you know, during those times. And I wanted to be a part of it. You know, it didn't feel right to just, you know, leave and not come back.
Across the country, we've seen really difficult and scary, like, anti-trans language and legislation. What are your suggestions for what allyship looks like for supporting people that are in this community and having a hard time right now?
Yeah, I would say it is really scary with everything that's happening in the country around all the anti-LGBTQ, anti-trans legislation and messaging. But what I would say during this moment, the political climate that we're in, we have to go back to being old school. And what I mean by that is like, we have to center like deep dive learning and deep dive involvement to really learn the nuances and the stories of people. For people who's looking to be supportive, to be allies, if you're looking to volunteer or you're looking to be involved, I want folks to not just be able to look from a broader sense and like volunteer short term. Really think about what's your long-term volunteer plan, your involvement plan, because you learn so much. You get to spend time with people. What I always like to say is like, we have to spend time with our people in the garden. It's only then that you actually know the nuances. You know, you can't be a good ally after just seeing like a short video. You know, you have to get involved. And I will also encourage people to just not just get involved with like the bigger organizations. The work that is ongoing to support LGBTQ people happens year round. And a lot of amazing like work to support like marginalized groups within the LGBTQ community happens year round, but it also goes unnoticed. And so I encourage people to think deeply about their involvement, but also look closer to pick a focus on where they want to get involved, because there's deeper communities even within the LGBTQ community.
We talked a little bit about like the Milwaukee queer community and about like 10 years ago, what you felt that it was lacking in comparison mm-hmm. to what you saw elsewhere. But you know, here now, involved with our community building here, what do you love about the Milwaukee queer community?
There's a lot of things that I love about the Milwaukee queer community. We're definitely a city that's impacted by a lot of segregation, right? So what that looks like is that there's a lot of queer communities and different communities who are kept separate too. But I think what I love about it is that, one, the city is great, right? I think geographically, I love the city. But I also really think that people in our community are thinking about these things, right? And are concerned about these things. And so even though we're very segregated in so many ways, I think that people's hearts are pulled together because of the issues that we're all similarly like connected to. I think pride looks really different here. I think like nonprofit and like advocacy services looks really different here. And so I really love that about our community here. And there's just this willingness to actually see each other within the nuances of like our own communities as queer folks, you know? And so I really love that about our city.
John Yang is the queer justice director at the Hmong American Women's Association. They spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. The Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project's mission is to document and reconnect the community with our hidden queer history. As with many marginalized groups, that history is often lost or goes undocumented. To learn about some local lesbian history, I'm joined by Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project board member Nicole Kerf. I'd love to dive into some local lesbian history, and let's start with Annie Hindel, starting way back in 1884. Who was she?
So Andy Hindel was actually the first internationally famous drag queen who happened to come to the Milwaukee Dime Museum in November of 1884. And when Andy made their appearance in the city, the local newspapers didn't really know what to make of her. She was reported as an ill-mannered male impersonator who happened to marry not only two women, but a man in three separate church weddings. So they decided that she was probably a man deceiving audiences all along. It's just she wasn't, but that's how they were reporting it back then.
Yeah, don't know what to make of it, so let's make a broad generalization.
Exactly. History doesn't always get it right.
Yeah. Well, and one of the challenges of history is trying to decipher clues from what's reported from this outside perspective. So let's dive into when there's a first mention of a first lesbian hangout here in Milwaukee. Where and when was that?
So we're in 1928 now, and we're at an establishment known as the St. Charles Hotel. And if you're familiar and unfamiliar with that, it was actually located across the street from the Milwaukee City Hall. And this one's interesting because it actually was raided by the FBI. When you look at their notes, they described it that fairy boys and bulldaggers were roaming the halls in search of gin parties, as well as chorus girls who may have not been girls after all. The lobby bar in the hotel was a half block long, and it often was packed with women from the Orpheum traveling circuit who were looking to hook up with other women. The St. Charles was so decadent that it was padlocked for an entire year by prohibition agents. So it was pretty scandalous.
Yeah, the scandal and the raids seemed to be the things in the papers, especially centuries ago, right? And we touched a bit upon it, but the challenges of trying to collect and preserve LGBTQ history and what this organization does is that it's a challenge, right? So what are some of the reasons that we honestly just don't know much about mid-century women's spots and other things about lesbian culture?
Well, it has to do with, you know, feeling safe. Safety has a lot to do with it, or not trusting if they don't know who you are. A good example of that is the Fin and Feather or the Wildwood. They didn't advertise to outsiders because they were suspicious of them, and they really fiercely defended their turf. But they were great spaces that supported women, especially when looking at women's sports teams, which includes softball in the summer and bowling in the winter. And these were also noted to have spaces for women to dance together, which wasn't, you know, always available in other spaces. And there was a very colorful history, especially at the Wildwood. So Josie Carter, who is a longtime contributor to our project, she told us a tale one night that there was these Amazon women, she called them, and they were a group of big diesel women who did not tolerate toxic masculinity. And one night, a drunk male stumbled into the bar, and he started hassling a Black patron in the bar. And one of the Amazons walked up to her and said, "Is he bothering you?" But she was too afraid to say yes. And the man kind of shot off his mouth and he said, "What are you going to do about it?" And called her a choice name. And she just wasn't going to have that. So she walked into the bathroom, took the toilet tank cover off of the toilet seat, and came back out and cracked him over the head with it. And the whole bar erupted in cheers. And it was just another night at the Wildwood.
Yeah, just another night can, I'm sure, be used as a phrase for a lot of bars in Milwaukee history here.
Yeah.
And obviously, gathering spaces are really important to LGBTQ history, especially lesbian history. And one of those places was called Stan's Nightbeat on 9th and National. Can you share a bit of Stan's Nightbeat's backstory?
So Stan's Nightbeat originally opened in 1959, and it was opened by a heterosexual couple named Stan and Carrie. And they deliberately opened a lesbian bar. And it became the hottest spot to be for the next 13 years. It was definitely a butch bar. So there was roles of butch and femme at this time because it was 65 years ago. And there was no either or. You had to make a choice. You were either in the butch camp or the femme camp. They later moved to 2nd and Pittsburgh. And it became an anchor point in the gay village by the end of the 60s. At that location, they had big open bay windows, but they soon ended up covering them over with plywood because people kept getting into fights and throwing each other through the windows. And the owners were not about dealing with nonsense. Carrie, in fact, was known to wield a shotgun. She kept behind the bar. If things were getting out of hand, she would kind of warn folks. And if they kept it up, she would actually take you out by your hair sometimes out the front door.
Well, and, you know, all these stories aren't just about wild and raucous and fight-filled nights, of course. And there's a big role that bar owners play. So I want to talk about Sharon Dixon. She worked at a couple of local gay bars before deciding to open her own, which was called the Sugar Shack.
Yeah, so Sharon Dixon actually was known to work at two bars in particular. One was called the Leaded Shade, and the other one was the River Queen. Those spaces inspired her to open up her own bar, which was a open space for women owned by women. And that's important to note because a lot of these bars back then were owned by straight couples, but they exploited the gay community because the gay dollars weren't going back into the community. So she wanted to change that. She opened up a bar with her partner, Joanne, and the Sugar Shack was on 135 East National in 1975. And it became very well known around the Midwest. People would travel here because they found out it was owned by the community and they wanted to contribute to supporting the bar. They did also defend their territory there when necessary. There's a tale that we uncovered while doing some research that two men came into the bar and they were causing trouble. And Sharon said, "You need to leave." And they refused. And so she got on the microphone in the bar and informed all the patrons, "Hey, we're no longer serving until these two guys leave." And they found a way to motivate those two men to leave very quickly. And in fact, one of them left so quickly that he dropped his wallet, which they had to call the police for. And they turned the wallet over. And when the police officer opened the wallet and looked at the ID, he noted that it belonged to the son of a police officer. So the women went back to partying that night, and I'm assuming that that son maybe got an earful from their dad later that night.
Well, and, you know, highlights the importance of safe spaces and owners who back up their patrons, right?
Exactly. And Sharon's adventures in bar ownership did not end there. Eventually, she split up with her partner, and she ended up opening a new bar on 15th and Scott, and that one is pretty well known to this day. It was called Kathy's Nut Hut, and it operated from 1980 to 2014. And for years, it threw something called Fanny's Fest, which was a longtime lesbian institution, Fanny's. And it was a grassroots street fair. They helped raise money for the AIDS crisis, which is important to note. Sharon is no longer a bar owner. She's retired from it. But she was very, very involved in a lot of the work years ago.
Nicole Kurth is the Pride Center coordinator at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and a board member of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project. A note to our listeners, I am a volunteer community advisor for the History Project. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the House of History, a project dedicated to sharing local Black LGBTQ+ history. But first, Officer DeJorn Gauthier made history last summer as the first openly transgender police officer in Wisconsin. We'll hear about his experience and his work coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Officer DeJorn Gauthier, or DJ as he's known by his colleagues, is the first openly transgender law enforcement officer in Wisconsin. He joined the Wisconsin State Fair Police Department in December of 2022. He previously worked 7 years in public safety at State Fair Park. Gauthier says he'd wanted to join the legal field in some capacity since he was a child. The justice system, law, and police work have always been a part of his life. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell talks with Gauthier about his journey to becoming an officer with the State Fair Police and the impact he hopes to have.
You mentioned just this passion for law is something that you've carried since you were a child. Did you always know that that would translate into being an officer? Was an officer your ultimate goal?
You know, being an officer definitely has been on my radar. You know what I mean? I wasn't sure if it was going to be or not, but that perfect opportunity had came with our new chief. And he is very strong on training and knowledge and having a very diverse and inclusive force. And so with that, you know, I just saw everything line up for me perfectly. I've had my experience, you know, within law as far as being a paralegal, being a legal assistant, and things like that from the court side, you know, being in suits. And now I wanted to see how it would be from the other side. And when I tell you that I truly enjoy and I'm so glad that I picked the department that I did, or that the department picked me, rather, that I'm very, very glad that I did. I would not choose any other department to work for.
You wouldn't choose any other department to work for, and you actually truly enjoy this work. So let's talk a bit more about that. What do you enjoy most about working with the department so far? And, you know, what's also been challenging about it, if anything, so far?
Absolutely. I think one of the best things, and this was there all of my years at working at State Fair Park, working with an open-armed employer, as well as specifically when it comes to law enforcement, being able to see the smiles on children's faces, no matter what race, what religion, what gender, right? Just seeing kids, seeing that officers are there to help. One of the things that I love that my chief said is that we all wear the same badge. And that is so true. It does not matter that I am trans when I am there. When I'm walking the ground, I am there doing the same thing that any other officer that is there. And that is to make sure that our community is safe and that they understand that we are someone that they can go to if they need help, whether it is just finding where the closest restroom is or if it is something where it is even a medical emergency. And I think the experience that I had this year truly zoned in on that, being able to wear the same uniform with the folks that I have worked with over the past 6 years and even some newcomers, and collaborating and being a team was just so amazing. It felt so good. And that is one of the biggest perks, like I said, and being repaid with smiles from kids from very young ages, you know, all the way to even teenagers, even some of the ones who were possibly getting in trouble, you know what I mean? And then them being able to calm down and see that we are just as human as they are, seeing that we will treat them with respect. And all of that was just so amazing. And so that's a huge perk. As far as any challenges, I have yet to really see any challenges come my way. But what I can tell you in general, as a law enforcement officer, being able to stay fit, being able to tolerate stress and high stress situations throughout training or even in actual situations, that's an ongoing challenge. That is something that every officer will face, again, no matter what department you're with, no matter who you are. And that is something, again, going kind of back to a perk that my department, my team has helped with making sure that each one of our officers is okay. That's why I'm saying I really truly feel included, and I would not pick any other department.
Folks who make history don't generally set out to do so, right? It kind of just happens. And I think that's essentially what you've done just with being the first out trans officer. What does that mean to you?
You know, really, I like to say that, you know, it's not about what I am, it's about who I am. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm going to revert back to the quote from the chief of that we all wear the same badge. And you're absolutely right, where this was not something that I was set out to do. It just so happened to be. And it just so happened to be with Wisconsin State Fair Park Police, right? And it means a lot, though, because I do understand that this is a historic moment. But again, I want everyone to know that the history would not have been made if I didn't have every single one of my command staff, every single one of the officers that have been behind me. If I did not have everyone in the police academy, from my classmates to my instructors, to be able to help me get through, right? I had to get through that part before I, you know, could even wear a badge, right? Mm-hmm. So it was a team effort. So this is not about me at all. This is about everyone that was a part of this journey, helped me become the officer that I am, helped me get this historic moment going, and it's not going to be the last. Again, I am just the first of something that I'm sure that there are trans and non-binary officers that are on a force somewhere in the state of Wisconsin, somewhere across the United States, right? And it is just going to be for their time that they feel safe, that they feel okay to be able to say that they are.
Absolutely. And I think you make a great point with just being able to have the moment where they can feel safe enough to just be themselves, where it shouldn't be a big deal. Like, it's obviously important, but it's like you said, it's not about what you are, it's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
My next question kind of goes along to that safety, because obviously we're at a point in this country, right, where trans lives, particularly Black trans lives, are in danger, mm-hmm. whether it's attacks on trans rights or just trans existence in general. I know you said you have the support of your team, right? And it was the team that got you to be the officer that you are. But I'm also wondering, like, do you think about that danger that is just right now against trans people? Like, do you think about that in your role as an officer? And how do you navigate that if that is something that you're thinking about?
Sure, absolutely. So the key part of this question here is that, honestly, it has nothing to do with being an officer at all. Being a Black trans person, you know, just in general living and breathing, is something where I need to be aware of my safety at all times. Being an officer, again, separated from being trans, you need to be aware and have your head on a swivel, you know, at all times, right? Safety matters. So all we're doing here is just kind of like combining the two. But so yes, absolutely. No matter what, I'm always worried about my safety. I'm worried about my family's safety. I'm worried about my coworker's safety, right? Because of the field that we work in. But directly with being trans, my thing is that you don't see that I'm trans, okay? That is not something that pops up when you see me in uniform, okay? What is seen is going to be my color. What is seen is going to be how my communication skills are, right? And how I can de-escalate a situation. And so with that being said, I'm thinking every encounter that I have with an individual, regardless, like I said, if it is, you know, something good and, you know, community service wise, or if it is something that is, you know, a criminal act, things like that, no matter what, I am still going to rely on my training. I'm still going to rely on my experiences of what I know as an officer, but also what I know as a trans person, right? One of the things that you learn in the academy is officer override. And that is, you know, if there is an officer that, you know, maybe is just taking a step too far, or you just need to override literally what the term itself sounds like. We need to just override that officer. Maybe you need to step in. Keeping that in mind, right, for folks that may not have encountered other trans and non-binary individuals, right, knowing that I am one and may be able to communicate, you know, with those situations. And again, I have an awesome department. I know it seems like a little over the top, but I have an awesome department where even during the fair, you know, if one of my fellow officers had a question or they did not know, they came to ask. They knew, right? That's a perk of being out, is that my team knows that I am there. And so if they have questions, if they have concerns, they know they can ask so that they can, again, have that pro-com and that approachable method to be able to do it right, to make whoever we're encountering feel safe.
So I guess my final question, and, you know, we kind of got a little into it anyway. You talked about you didn't set out to make history, right? There are other, you know, trans, non-binary folk in law enforcement, and they just have to feel safe enough to walk in who they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm getting at is, even though all of that has been said, like, what impact do you think or hope your presence with the Wisconsin State Fair Police has for Black trans people, especially those who want a career in law enforcement?
Yeah, I hope the impact is that youth understand that police are here to help. I also, specifically, the impact I want is not necessarily for a trans or non-binary person, right? Mm-hmm. We know we exist. We know that mm-hmm. we can have any career as anyone else. We know that. The impact that I am making is with my team. We all wear the same badge, right? And that is being represented. When folks see that, they know and understand, no matter who you are, right, that there is an opportunity for you. So it's not just me making history. It's our department that is making history. It is our department that is laying a foundation and saying, look, we still can do police work, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. Didn't make any difference that we added this guy, right? I think one of the best things it was to kind of wrap this up is my supervisor, right? You'd ask him and you'd be like, so what's the best thing about working with BJ? He'd be like, I don't know how you want me to answer that question. I mean, he's like working with anybody else, right? Because, and that's the whole thing. That's the impact right there, right?
Yeah.
That it's normal. It's regular. It's the same. There is no difference, and that is the impact that I want to make, is that we are here, we exist, and as employers, you can welcome us in, and we're going to do our job as a team, right, and be successful as a team to be able to protect the whole state of Wisconsin, right, like as a team, and that is the impact that I want to make. The other side impacts, the co-impacts, they'll just fall in place on their own. You know, a kid is going to be sitting in front of the TV, they're, you know, or listening to a podcast or whatever, and they're going to hear who I am. But the thing is, I don't want them to say that I want to be like him. I want them to say, I want to work for a department like State Fair Park. That's what I want them to say.
DeJorn Gauthier is a Wisconsin State Fair police officer. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell last summer. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts. The House of History is a project that's working to uncover and preserve the stories of Black LGBTQ people. We'll learn about that work next on Lake Effect on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Janice Toy has long been a part of Milwaukee's LGBTQ history. She's one of Milwaukee's most legendary entertainers and one of the founding members of SHEBA, or Sisters Helping Each Other Battle Adversity, a support group for Black women of trans experience. Toy is on a mission to make sure Milwaukee's Black LGBTQ+ history is preserved and shared through the House of History. The House of History is a project dedicated to collecting and sharing local Black LGBTQ+ history through interviews, as well as uncovering and sharing photographs, as well as other artifacts that tell the stories of Black LGBTQ+ people in Milwaukee. Toy joins me now to explain how she went from being a part of local Black LGBTQ+ history to preserving it.
Well, with the House of History, you know, this gives me the opportunity to, I guess, document a lot of the girls who have passed, you know, I guess to document, you know, their life legacy, you know, because sometimes when people die, you know, we forget. And a lot of the younger transgender community, they don't know the struggles that a lot of the girls had to go through before them. You know, now there's a lot of programs, you know, that's targeted to kind of help transgender. But when I first came out, a lot of those programs weren't available, you know, so they don't know the struggles and the hard work that the older girls had to put in, you know, and a lot of the newer girls, you know, that's just coming out and don't even know that it was a girl who, you know, who the struggles that she went through to get, you know, it passed for us to get our name changed and, you know, to just to be able to live, you know, this lifestyle that people take, you know, advantage of, you know, so.
Can you share how it was born? I understand you connected with Bryce Smith of the LGBTQ Milwaukee, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you share how you both came together to bring this idea about?
Well, he was interviewing just some Sheba, you know, members. And it was just like a instant connection me and him had, you know, and then he just, you know, just introduced me to other different, you know, programs and stuff that he had and, you know, ideas that, you know, he wanted to, you know, bring about. And I just jumped aboard and it was like an instant connection.
Yeah, he was originally in touch with you to learn more about Sheba, which is sisters helping each other battling adversity, and talking about the programs that exist today. You're one of the founding members of Sheba. I'd love to learn more about why and how you started this organization and what it looked like in its early days compared to now.
Well, Sheba, it was a group because, I mean, I was just one of the first members that joined. But, I mean, it started off with sisters helping each other battle AIDS. But then a lot of girls kind of were, I guess they didn't like the title, you know, of AIDS being associated, you know, with being, you know, transgender or whatever. Because I guess a lot of people got a misunderstanding that everybody that was in the group or in order to be a part of the group, you had to be, you know, HIV positive, which wasn't the case. And so, you know, they wanted to take away that negative title, so then it got changed to, you know, adversity or whatever. But, you know, we involved, you know, now it's kind of like, you know, they help with a lot of employment. They do clothing drives. They do more outings. They offer needle exchange. They offer programs to help girls get hormones, you know, because I guess in the earlier days, you know, a lot of those programs weren't available, you know, to us as transgender. You know, a lot of, you know, people, if you didn't have insurance or you just didn't have the money, you know, you were just buying it, you know, from off the street, you know, whatever. You know, so it's kind of like we, you know, offer a lot of different things to help girls, you know, to stay on the right path, you know, and, because a lot of times, you know, people think that Black trans women or trans, you know, people in general, you know, the only thing that we were eligible for was either sex work or doing drag shows. You know, we couldn't have like a regular job. We couldn't, you know, have the things that a normal person in society, you know, they felt like, you know, we weren't, you know, entitled to those things, you know. And now Sheba is, you know, we promote jobs and getting people, you know, into, you know, careers and different things like that.
If you're comfortable, would you mind sharing about your own journey coming out and your relationship with your mother and how she influenced your outlook and activism in helping other people in the roles you play yourself?
I had a very strong, you know, relationship with my mother. You know, my mother, unfortunately, you know, I lost her a few years ago due to COVID. But, you know, she was a very strong person in my life. I mean, like I said, we were very, very close. You know, she didn't look at me, you know, differently or treated me any differently. You know, she always gave me the motivation that I needed and pushed me, you know, to want different things in my life. And she always made me believe that I could do anything regardless of my sexuality or because I chose to be trans. You know, she always, you know, told me that, you know, I can always come to her and I could talk to her about anything. You know, I didn't have to feel embarrassed or, you know, and she opened her, you know, her home to any of, you know, all of my friends. Like if people, you know, didn't have anything to eat, they were able to come to her house and sit down and get a meal. You know, if they needed a place to stay, she opened up her house to them. You know, my mother was very loving, you know, and very supportive, you know, of my lifestyle. And I guess because of that, I was able to give back. And I guess I just felt, you know, like there was always something I wanted to do to help others, because I had was fortunate enough to have someone in my life, you know, because a lot of times, you know, family members, they turn their back on you once they find out, you know, that you're trans or you're even living into a gay lifestyle, you know, they turn their back on you. And I had a strong support system. You know, my family was very supportive. And so I just wanted other girls to share in that, you know, they too could, you know, have someone in their corner to pick them up. You know, I wanted them to feel that family support, you know, that I felt coming up.
What did you discover about yourself when you took on the role of interviewing people and these members of the Black LGBTQ community?
Everyone has a story to tell. And sometimes, you know, because we had like a general questions, you know, that we kind of like asked everyone, but everyone had like a different answer. And some things you didn't even know about. I didn't even know about, you know, some of the individuals, and I've been knowing some of them for years, you know, but when you start getting into asking certain questions, you just got, you know, all these different answers. And then it was opening up, you know, because, you know, it's like it was more like a friendship type of thing. So they were comfortable with sharing these stories, something that, you know, they probably wouldn't have told anyone else. But because they felt comfortable with our friendship, you know, they opened up and they didn't have a problem with, you know, sharing these different things. And some of these stories I was even blown away by.
And along with the people you talk to, the sense of place and community also plays a big role for Milwaukee's queer community. And most people are familiar with Walker's Point being the area with most of the city's gay bars. But can you share the history of the gay bars on Milwaukee's north side and the role that they played in your life?
A lot of the bars that I guess I went to on the north side when I first came out are no longer here. But when they were open, you know, it just gave me a place of being able to be myself. I didn't have to hide who I was. I didn't have to pretend, you know, and put on a fake smile. You know, I could let my hair down. You know, I could just be myself. And it was a loving, you know, situation, because it was like you were around like-minded people, you know, that didn't judge you or didn't look down on you because of something that you had on or because, you know, you were different. You know, it was just, I guess, just a loving, you know, situation, you know, to be around people, you know, that didn't judge you, you know, and you were able to have a good time.
Throughout your memories or the interviews you've been conducting, can you share with us a person that you interviewed whose stories are not just impactful, but a story that you think is worth sharing?
Well, I guess the one story that kind of touched me a little more was the one with Ronnie Grace. You know, I've been knowing him for years, and he's been one of the facilitators at Diversity Resilient with the Sheba. You know, I guess, you know, hearing his struggle and, you know, a lot of the things that, you know, he went through in other states that he lived in and things, you know, with health issues and, you know, just a lot of things across the board that he was dealing with. It was just very heartwarming, you know, to know that throughout of everything that he went through, you know, he's still here and he made, you know, different sacrifices. And a lot of things that he did, you know, helped the community. And a lot of the programs that he started and, you know, was a part of are successful, you know, because of him. And so, you know, I was just glad that I was able to, you know, learn a lot of, you know, different things. I was just touched by, you know, his interview.
And with you yourself learning new things with people you've known for years, collecting their histories, how do you hope the House of History Project will connect with and impact Black LGBTQ plus Milwaukeeans especially?
Well, you know, I guess my goal is to get the word out, you know, that we're here. And a lot of the sacrifices that were made by some of the people who are no longer here, their legacy can live on. You know, because everyone in our family, you know, has someone in the LGBT community, whether they want to admit it or not, you know, it's someone in somebody's family, you know, whether they're in the closet or they're not. And, you know, their stories, you know, need to be told. This was a way that, you know, it was a life-changing experience, you know, and it was a way to make history and, you know, to keep history, you know, going. And I think that this website, you know, would give that, I guess, that opportunity, you know, to get that word out and get that connection, you know, that we need.
Absolutely. Well, Janice, I want to thank you so much for your time today and for all your work in preserving this local history.
I would thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to me and, you know, just being, you know, that connection that we need, you know, to get the word out.
Janice Toy is the mother of the House of History, a project dedicated to collecting and sharing local Black LGBTQ+ history. We spoke last year. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the millions of cicadas emerging from the ground this summer. Plus, we'll learn about Milwaukee's long history of drag performance. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.